This week in Retronauts, bread makes you fat. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts episode, you know what? I keep doing this every damn time. I start the podcast and then I think, oh, wait, what episode is this? It's so much punchier and better and more incisive if I know. This is episode 392 of Retronauts, unless that changes, in which case this will be a different episode. So that's the definitive word. You have it here. I am Jeremy Parrish, being definitive and incisive and possibly wrong. And this week, that's actually pretty appropriate because we're going to be talking about a media franchise very heavily patterned after video games and, reaching into video games based around a character who is incisive and bold and often wrong. It is Scott Pilgrim, courtesy of Brian Lee O'Malley and a film by Edgar Wright and a video game by a bunch of people. We'll get into that later. But we are going to talk about this franchise, which has very deep video game hooks and was one of the first media properties to embrace the idea of video games, not as like, hey, wouldn't it be funny if our character was turned into a video game character just for this one episode and made Pac-Man sounds, but actually rather like there was an element of literacy and familiarity with video games, which is something that we take for granted in media now. It's just there, like it's baked into it. But in 2004, when Scott Pilgrim's Precious Little Life debuted, that was not the case at all. And so, you know, there is kind of a monumental milestone element to this property. And also, it was turned into a video game that very recently came back after a nearly decade-long hiatus of unavailability. And it's a very good video game. So it just makes sense to talk about all these things because it is retro, it is gaming, even when it's not gaming, it's Scott Pilgrim. Anyway, here on the phone, or actually Google Meet with me, that's like the modern day telephone. Who do we have? Let's see, a Retronauts regular over in the UK.
Hello, I'm Stuart Jip, and I am Sonic & Knuckles 1234.
And let's see, who else? There's another JP on the podcast. It's a little bit of a, I don't know, like there's some cloning going on here. I'm JP, there's the other JP. Who are you, JP?
This is the Clone Saga. I'm JP Swartzlander. Hi.
Are you on podcasts where someone might recognize you from the Greenlit Podcast Network?
I am co-host of Whatever Nerd on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
Marvelous. And finally, I don't have anything fun to say about your name or presence or anything, but for a while we thought you were an ant and then possibly a chipmunk. Who are you?
Hey, to paraphrase Wallace Wells, it's that one guy, Aaron Littleton.
All right. So, yes, Scott Pilgrim. Thank you guys for joining me for this episode. I'm looking forward to this because I've been a fan of Scott Pilgrim series in its various iterations since it was introduced to me by my own roommate back in the days of working at 1UP.com. Nick Maragos was like, hey, you should read this comic. And I read it and I was like, whoa, this is really good. And then I bought the rest and read them. And then I got to actually put together a big strategy guide, art book, retrospective interview book for Scott Pilgrim versus the World Complete Edition, I believe it's called, for Limited Run Games. And that was, you know, kind of everything coming together. It was very nice. So let me ask you, before we get started in this discussion, where did you happen to encounter Scott Pilgrim? Like, what's your history with the series? And, you know, just up front, like, what are your thoughts, just kind of in general, in brief, on the property and like which parts of it you think work best? Let's go backward here. Aaron.
Well, I believe it was introduced to me by a website called Toasty Frog, which I used to be a big fan of. I don't know what that guy's up to these days.
I don't know. So we've got ants, we've got squirrels, we've got frogs. I see where this is going. Place.
I'm a big animal guy. I remember just around places I would visit on the internet. I think Toasty Frog was probably the first place I read about it. But I think it started showing up in other webcomics, like little references to it. I seem to recall there was a strip from PvP, that classic strip, that was a blatant ripoff of Scott Pilgrim, a joke from Scott Pilgrim. And the next day he was like, oh, it was a reference to Scott Pilgrim. I didn't rip Scott Pilgrim off. And
it's
just,
homage.
Yeah, it's an homage. So eventually, I think the first physical media I had of Scott Pilgrim was a Free Comic Book Day comic that was released. I think that was the first thing I read from it, which is in the middle of the story.
Yes, that's a very difficult place to get started on Scott Pilgrim, to be honest.
Which story is that? Is it like a bespoke sort of story? I can't remember.
Yes.
Go ahead. I'll let you tell us.
Yeah, I believe he fights Winifred Haley, mm-hmm. which is the co-star of Todd Ingram's movie that is
Lucas Lee. Lucas Lee's film.
Oh, Lucas Lee.
Todd is the bassist,
yes.
who is a part of the Clash at Demon Head.
Yes, you're right. Lucas Lee's co-star. I don't think she's actually featured in the main volumes, but she's mentioned.
She is not. She is mentioned in the volumes, and they. She's had a rough life for a fictional character. She was written out of the books and just included in the Free Comic Book Day story. She was like briefly going to be included in the movie, and then she got written out somehow. Then she was going to be a boss, I believe. Like a mid-boss in the second stage of the video game, and then they pushed her out of that too. So she's just like a background character. So Winifred Haley really, she's got it rough. But at least
she keeps trying.
I know, right? But you probably have this totally skewed perception of her because that was the first thing you read. So you were like, wow, this character must be super important. But you're so
right.
You're so wrong. Anyway, okay.
Well, you know, Scott Pilgrim is an unreliable narrator, so it fits in very well with that whole theme.
Mm-hmm. In multiple meanings,
yes.
He's very unreliable.
Really just kind of embodies that word. What about you, JP?
The first time I ever heard about it, my first experience was it was whenever they first started production on the movie, and... it was some site, I can't remember, it was Ain't It Cool or somewhere, and they mentioned Scott Pilgrim, and they said, oh, this is a big graphic novel hit, well, relatively big for, you know, for the time, and they were like, you know, here's what the comic looks like, we don't know what it's going to look like or anything, but, you know, keep your eyes peeled, and I was like, huh, that art looks really cool, and so I looked it up, and I was like, yeah, this is really cool, and I started reading it, and I fell in love with it. And then I was like proselytizing it to everyone that would listen for more than 3 seconds about how cool this comic is. And, you know, of course, everyone's just like, whatever, shut up. And then, of course, the movie comes out and everyone's like, have you seen this? And I'm like, yes.
And how about yourself, Stuart?
I walked in 2004, American Graffiti, which is a comic shop in Barnstable, North Devon. Don't look for it. Retronauts listeners, it's not there anymore. And I randomly picked up volume 1 off of the shelf, and I was like, this looks sort of like manga, I'm going to buy it. And I read it, and it was great. So I'm cooler than all of you in a weird sort of way, because I was there right at the beginning. This is the only way I'm cool in any respect, so don't feel bad about it. But then I was pretty much like, I guess what people used to be like for Harry Potter, sort of waiting for all the new volumes to come out, and like camping out outside of Forbidden Planet and stuff. But yeah, I got really into it. I got really into the video game. I wasn't very impressed with the film, but just a big fan of the comics. Really went and looked at the other stuff that Brian Lee O'Malley did, like Lost at Sea, which I think was pretty much it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of woke me up to, I guess, independent American comics as well, because I was only reading manga at the time.
Yeah,
so big influence.
Yeah, there's definitely a gateway element here because Scott Pilgrim crosses over between a lot of different fandoms and genres. It does a lot of things all at once, and you could almost consider it an early example of OEM, original English manga, but it's not really like, you know, so Brian Lee O'Malley, you mentioned he had only had one work published before this, a graphic novel called Lost at Sea.
Yeah, that I was aware of anyway. Yeah.
No, that's correct, I believe. Okay. That was his one work prior to this, and it's a very different kind of work. It's a slice of 3 days of a teenage girl's life, and it's very just kind of, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot that happens. It's very much like a sort of a teenage angst sort of thing. And he's said that, you know, like, he kind of was just working through his own memories of being a teenager there, and his own kind of like, this is so important to me. Oh my God, the world's over. Even though really in the grand scheme of things, what does it really matter? So
yeah, I actually read Lost at Sea this morning, sort of in preparation for this, and it took me about 30 minutes. It's a very different kind of work.
Yeah. Since your memories are fresh, would you like to talk about it a little bit? Maybe you and Stuart?
Sure. So I find it interesting. Brian Lee O'Malley seems to write stories from the almost like previous period of his life. He's not writing something that just happened to him. He's writing things about his life 5 or 6 years before. And so this comic, I think, pretty well sums up the feelings I think you have as a sort of listless late teenager, or at least I had, or a lot of people can maybe feel a kinship to. I think Scott Pilgrim is the same way. I think he wrote it when he was in his late 20s, mid to late 20s, about being in early 20 something, which is, I think we all know, a very different time. It's something that feels like it would be very deep to someone in their mid 20s, but later on it's maybe, I wouldn't call it surface level, but it's just a very honest opinion of one's own emotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's said that, you know, the stuff he's written, especially Scott Pilgrim, were very much a product of being at a certain point in his life, that there are, you know, things he couldn't revisit, he couldn't do at a later point of his life. So I think that's definitely true. And Scott Pilgrim, he has said, you know, was pretty heavily based on a period of his life where he lived in Toronto with a gay roommate, trying to break through with a band that wasn't all that great. And so he channeled a lot of himself into Scott Pilgrim. I have to, you know, I want to believe that he as a person was not as bad as Scott is. But he has also said in interviews that he invited a bunch of his friends from that period to the premiere of the movie and said it was very awkward because he kind of realized, like, he was telling the story of things that happened to that group from his perspective, where he was the hero, and not everyone necessarily like came away feeling the same way. So, you know, there's some parallels to the original work there as well, I guess. All right, so Scott Pilgrim began as a graphic novel in 2004. That was when Oni Press published the first volume. And, you know, I don't think there were huge expectations for that. O'Malley has said he expected it to sell. He hoped it would sell like 1,000 copies. At this point, more than 1 million volumes of Scott Pilgrim books have been published. So I would say, you know, it took on a life of its own and became much bigger than he ever expected or intended or hoped. Which, you know, that's a rare kind of breakout success. But again, I think it's a case of a time and place where it just happened to be something so different, but at the same time really captured a lot of things that were kind of, you know, really kind of bubbling beneath the surface of pop culture and, you know, especially on the internet. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I definitely feel like a certain kinship with the original work here, just because I feel like Brian Lee O'Malley and I come from somewhat similar backgrounds. I mean, he's a half Korean Canadian, so that's not similar for me, a white American. But at the same time, like, I, you know, having read interviews with him, read his work, interviewed him myself, like we share a lot of formative experiences playing NES games growing up, you know, getting into manga and anime in the mid 90s, especially with like stuff like Ranma One Half, Neon Genesis Evangelion, you know, just kind of that whole splinter of nerddom that, speaking for myself, growing up in that era with my interests and tastes, I tended to feel kind of isolated. And like, you know, I had friends who liked some of the stuff I liked, but they kind of drifted away over time. And, you know, I still enjoyed these things. And it just always felt like I don't really have anyone to share this with. And so reading a book like this, you know, it kind of reflected the internet communities that I found, where I was like, oh, there's, there are a lot of people out there who enjoy this stuff. And here is a work that kind of channels that in a way that I find really relatable. And it's also, you know, a character driven story with a lot of goofy action and just, you know, crosses over into a lot of different genres that I enjoy and doesn't take itself too seriously, but still isn't just like completely ridiculous. It just really kind of hit all the right notes at a great time.
I think it sort of, I came into it sort of by osmosis in a way, because I didn't have this experience, because they're not going to make a comic about some guy playing the Spectrum. It's not going to happen. So I sort of came into it through, like you said, the sort of the communities, the online communities, that you'd quickly find this sort of shared experience of what people were playing and, you know, doing and listening to. But the way that it does integrate those experiences, one of the things that I think makes the comic work more than really most of the other media based on Scott Pilgrim, is it doesn't feel crowbarred in to go, look what I've heard of, if that makes sense. Like, I know this. It's very like understated in a way. And like in the first volume, it's such a small thing, but they play a song called Launchpad McQuack. And I remember seeing that and just kind of being like, that's a really odd cut to throw in there, like, but it sort of makes sense, you know. I don't know how to explain exactly what I'm getting at, to be honest, but
yeah,
you know what I mean? It's like kind of it rings true. It doesn't feel like they're trying to capture any kind of, I don't know, zeitgeist, is that the word? Like in the movie, I felt like a lot of the video game stuff was just there to go, oh, I remember that.
Yeah,
but in this, it feels like it's part of the sort of texture of the characters' lives,
right?
Which really works.
Yes, Aaron, I think you were going to say something, or maybe JP.
Well, I mean, I will say, so I think it's hard to talk about Scott Pilgrim without getting personal about it. At least it is for me, because just like you said, it wraps up a certain period of pop culture and nostalgia. And it felt in a way almost transgressive at the time. Like, is it really okay for media to be talking about other media? Like, clearly now it's, no one has any problem at all with having video games be the basis of another media property.
At this point, media no longer has anything to say itself. It's just like, hey, let's talk about other media.
Right. It sort of slots in there with something like a Clerks of like independent film, where it was a movie about talking about other movies. But it just the next generation's version of that.
Yeah. It's kind of like you said, you know, it's hard to talk about without it being like, I mean, it's always, you know, no matter what media you're talking about, it's going to be colored by your own experiences. But like, this was something that I, at the time, like, I don't know about y'all, but like, I heavily related to Scott, and it took me a while to realize how bad that was. But yeah, I was at the time of reading it, I was a early 20s. Jobless, selfish, obsessed with retro games, and like all my friends would be out doing, you know, actual stuff with their life, and like me, I would, you know, to quote Scott, I would be like, oh, I learned the bass line from the Final Fantasy II. It's like, yeah, you know, that's the kind of stuff I was doing. And so I was like, oh, cool, this is a comic story about me. And then like the more I read it, and then I would go back and read the earlier ones, and I'm like, I'm kind of a shithead. I'm kind of a loser.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible to relate to elements of Scott without necessarily going, you know, whole cloth and being like, yes, I'm an abuser, I'm terrible.
But it kind of made me look at myself from an outside perspective. And it did lead to positive growth for me. I feel like I'm a much better person than I used to be.
I think it sort of, it's like a bit of an inversion of the kind of webcomics that were around that time, where you'd get your gamer guy who just was completely narcissistic, but was beloved by women sort of thing. I think it's like an interesting kind of inversion of that by presenting a character who's, I guess, kind of like that, and then taking more of a realistic sort of lens to it as the volumes kind of wear on. It gets more and more weird and dark and depressing.
But also more grounded.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think to really kind of understand what made this book so unique in 2004 is to really kind of understand the media landscape at the time. Someone mentioned just a few minutes ago Clerks, and that's a great reference, because, you know, there was a sense that it was cool to love old movies and to love old music. You know, Quentin Tarantino basically built a career by sort of chewing up all the movies he loved and regurgitating them as like a baby bird paste, while filling it with the soundtracks that were just basically taken from his record shelves. And like, that was his career, was doing that and kind of reinventing the stuff in a kind of a fresh, like modern, harder edged way. And you know, obviously Kevin Smith, was really big into that too, but you didn't have that kind of acceptance for, you know, video games, for comics, for a lot of, you know, even like the indie rock that Scott was really into. I mean, you had, oh crap, I totally forgot the guy's name. Not Cameron Crowe.
A guy?
Yeah, it was Cameron Crowe, the director, who you know, made a bunch of kind of movies sort of centered around indie music in the 90s. But you know, you didn't really have kind of an open love for, and like, this is integral to my being, that sensation in that work, the way you did here. I mean, Scott Pilgrim is named for a song by an indie band called Plumtree. So, you know, it kind of wears its influences right out there on its sleeve, on its jacket. And that just, you didn't really see a lot of that. I mean, I think in the Ready Player One world, in a post Family Guy, it's just kind of accepted that, you know, media is just about processing other media. But this was different at the time. And if you wanted to find something, if you were into the sort of things that kind of informed and shaped Scott Pilgrim, you pretty much had to go online. And someone mentioned webcomics earlier, and that's a great example, because, or a great I don't know, citation, I guess, because you're right. Those were written very much from a, like, hey, it's, you know, it's basically me. Here's my proxy. But in the comic, he's really cool and smart and all the ladies love him. And yeah, I have got like a toy robot who follows me around and is cool.
I certainly would not want to make a link between the person I'm about to talk about and those sorts of trashy comics. But I reread Scott Pilgrim during the pandemic just as, you know, to do something. And not too long after that, I found myself on archive.org. I was trying to pull up something somewhere, but I ended up on a very old copy of Scott Sharkey's webpage. And I just sort of, you know, perused some of the articles that used to be up there on Solid Sharkey. And it was very, very similar tone. Like, there's probably a universe out there where this is called Scott Sharkey versus the world instead of Scott Pilgrim versus the world. But this sort of thing was happening online. And in a way, it was, I think there was that feeling that print media, that broadcast media was somehow a realer, more important media in the early 2000s. And so you could have these little communities growing up online. But when this sort of thing hit print media, I think it made everyone go, oh, wait a minute. This is like an important enough part of pop culture, an important enough part of like at least someone's identity socially, that it can have a print comic about it. And I think that was almost the most surprising thing about Scott Pilgrim. Not that it existed at all, just that the medium that it existed in.
That it existed in a physical object that people would pay money for. Whereas, you know, like with web comics, a lot of times, you know, they, like you said, were seen as less legitimate. And I certainly had friends who felt that way. And I was big into web comics. Like at one point, I couldn't tell you how many I was reading, like during high school, or post high school, but, it was pretty much, that was my main source of entertainment. And I would try and show it to people and they would be like, well, okay, that's an internet comic. I want a real comic.
Right. It's fine, but this is not real. And then
and I'd be like, I bought the novel of it. You can read that if you want. And they're like, no, I want a real one.
I mean, I certainly lived through the, like, you know, kind of ground zero of that transition in the that decade. I started, you know, working at OneUp.com shortly before this book came out. And at the time, it was kind of the online adjunct to magazines like Electronic Gaming Monthly, Official PlayStation Magazine, Game Now at the time. That lasted for like 2 months after I started working there. You know, GMR. There were a whole bunch of magazines, and Ziff Davis, the publisher, thought, well, we need to have an online presence. So they started up their website. But for the first few years, there was a real sense that we were like these parasites who were, you know, leeching off the content created by the magazines. And, you know, there was just this kind of attitude within the company, like, it's those one-up people, you know, they want to republish our hard work, you know, for free when people should be buying it in a magazine. But then, you know, that started to shift, and the magazines started to go away one by one, and, you know, advertising started to shift online. And, you know, by the end, the magazines were all shut down, and basically the entire staff had either been laid off, or like the magazine staff had been laid off or shifted over to 1UP. So, you know, there was a transition in media consumption habits and, you know, kind of the viability and respectability of online media at that point. And, yeah, I feel like this is very much kind of a part of that. But also, you know, I think you have to be able to understand Scott Pilgrim, you kind of have to look at the sort of internet subcultures or, you know, like communities that existed. I mean, Brian Lee O'Malley was part of a, I don't know if it was exactly, I'd call it an artist collective, but, you know, basically a bunch of friends who had a website called Maison Otaku, which is a riff on Maison Ikkoku by Rumiko Takahashi, the creator of Ranma One Half. And they, you know, just had kind of like this website. I remember reading that back in the days of the anime web Turnpike, where you would like, basically, if you wanted to find something that was of interest to you and you liked anime, you'd go there and you'd be like, oh, there's, you know, 1,000 links here. I'm going to click on this one today and see where it takes me. And I remember that was one of the pages that I bookmarked. And, you know, my own site ended up being bookmarked from there because I made fun of Evangelion one time. So, you know, it was all a pretty small place. The sort of nerd cultures of the internet. It was a very different sort of environment than it is now. But, you know, that is kind of the primordial soup from which Scott Pilgrim was created. But then there's also a huge element, you know, of Brian Lee O'Malley's personal life and experiences and his relationship, not only with other people, but also with Toronto. You know, I, you know, in a way we probably should have had Nadia Oxford on here because she is based in Toronto. And, you know, when I've talked to her about Scott Pilgrim, she's like, oh yeah, yeah, I know this and that and that. So it's, you know, kind of, it just pulls from a lot of things, and there are a lot of video game references. And at the time, like I said, you know, this was way before Ready Player One. The only real example, like, I mean, there weren't that many games or books about games out there in the world. There was, you know, in terms of fiction, there was Lucky Wander Boy. I don't know if you've ever read that, but that was written by D.B. Weiss, who would go on to work on, you know, be one of the co-producers of Game of Thrones. And if you were like, wow, this guy doesn't know how to write an ending, well, that was apparent back with Lucky Wander Boy. It was it was an interesting book that just kind of didn't go anywhere. And you know, that was pretty much it. There were a few books of game history. You know, there was like Supercade by Van Burnham. Yeah, there was you know, the Phoenix books by Leonard Herman, Stephen Kent's First Quarter, and that was about it. There just wasn't that much content about video games out there. And
hey, so, let's not ignore the seminal works of FX9 and the Worlds of Power.
But were those really about video games?
No, they were, but they were not.
Ostensibly.
I mean, I would say Netflix has done a much better job adapting Castlevania than FX9 did.
Not one soda pop in that Netflix adaptation.
Right. So yeah, Scott Pilgrim kind of was born in that environment, that kind of cultural media environment. And it was tackling concepts and, you know, jokes and themes and things like that that you saw sometimes in web comics, but not in other comics, not in print comics. But it was not a web comic because it was, you know, it had an element of professionalism to it that, you know, is more than just the fact that it was printed on paper. Like there was a real kind of energy and charisma and personality to O'Malley's art. And mm-hmm. at the same time, you know, web comics, it's like no one read Scott McCloud and said, oh, we can, you know, reinvent comics the way Scott McCloud wants us to. You know, the webcomics of the era were all very much in the format of serialized newspaper comics. It was, you know, like day-to-day gags, basically. And mm-hmm. this wasn't that. Each book was written as a graphic novel, like 150 pages or so. And as such, you know, those stories had room to breathe for characters to develop kind of naturally and have kind of their own character arcs within each volume, you know, to have splash pages and creative dynamic layouts. You know, one of my favorite little bits in all the Scott Pilgrim books is I think in the first volume where basically Scott is trying to come up with a rejoinder against one of his friends who insults him, and he gets on the bus, and it's just this series of like panels getting smaller and smaller as the bus recedes into the distance with, mm-hmm. with Scott. And he's like coming up with delayed retorts as the bus disappears, and each panel, like his word balloon gets smaller and smaller and the words become harder and harder to read. It's just, you know, fun things like that, like really playing with the nature of the page in interesting ways. And there were a lot of dynamic elements and concepts that you just didn't see in webcomics at the time. So yeah, it's a very inventive work and one that I just immediately gravitated toward.
I guess since you brought it up, I actually find the artwork in the first few volumes considerably more fun than the later mm-hmm. volumes.
I agree. Totally agree with that. Yeah.
He firms up his art. And I think there are actually a couple of extra artists he hires to help him out with some of the sort of broader images that he draws with more people. O'Malley, that is. And I think the series sort of loses a lot of energy as it goes on, partly because the story becomes less energetic, but then also that art loses that fluidity. It loses a lot of creativity that exists in that first couple of volumes. And it's probably I think where we all got to with it. I think I picked up Scott Pilgrim when the third volume was first released. So those first three volumes went down pretty quickly for me. And then I was at the point where I was waiting on Scott Pilgrim. And the story itself is such a, I don't want to say it's like an important story, but it's a story of youth and energy, and it's laid back in its own sort of way. The stakes are never particularly high. And suddenly it being this event, like, okay, wow, the new Scott Pilgrim book is coming out next month. That sort of anticipation, I think, rolled right in with the like less free artwork for me anyway. In a way that made me enjoy those latter volumes less. And I felt the same way when I reread these recently. I enjoyed the first part much more than the latter part.
I feel like the earlier stuff is more, I don't like using this as a description because it's so broad, but you'll get what I mean. It looks more sort of indie comics-ish. It's a lot scratchier and sort of not clean at all, basically. It looks like it's been sketched out, and Volume 3 is leading in that direction, but then after that, it starts to look really clean. Like, the characters start to look like promotional enamel pins of themselves in a weird way.
Right.
like they get kind of bug-eyed and they look a bit kind of Tezuka-ish. Is that fair to say? I don't know. They start to get cutesy and...
Well, I mean, around volume 3, he discovered Osamu Tezuka, so...
Tezuka, not Tezuka. Okay.
That could account for a lot of that. Mm.
I do like the later stuff. I do like it. I'm not saying I don't like it. I just think it is very... Like, you look at volume 6, then you look at volume 1, and it's like, what is this?
I think part of it is also just kind of... the nature of working on a long form project, you know, number one, you're going to go into it with more energy. I would say also that it might have something to do with, you know, the refinement of his skills and maybe the hiring of extra staff to help him with stuff. But also part of the fact that as the books go, like, it starts out fantastical and a lot more lighthearted, and it gets more dark and a little darker and more grounded as you get closer to the finale. Like, it starts becoming, it becomes less, you know, less Kirby, let more Dark Souls, I guess, to make an example.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have to also have to consider that the creator passed through his 20s during the course of creating this book. Like, he grew up, and it's, you know, as someone who creates, you're just going to see an evolution in your work. I mean, like, the only real exception I can think of is Sluggy Freelance. God bless that guy. Like, that,
still going.
I don't think it is, but I checked in on it like 4 or 5 years ago, and it looked exactly the way it did in 1997. It's amazing. Like, he
That's
just
pretty impressive.
He lives in stasis, or lived. I don't know. I don't know where it is now. But for most people, it's just natural to evolve, to refine, to say, well, you know, like, I did this, but I feel like I could have done it better. I feel like that's not really, it doesn't really represent what I wanted to do. And now, you know, I have, my brain is more powerful than my hand, and I have greater control, and I can draw things the way I want. So, yeah, I don't know. I just feel like, you know, it's, there's a pretty natural progression in the artwork throughout the series, and it definitely ends in a different place than it starts, but so does the story. And so do the characters. And so, I don't know, it all kind of hangs together. And especially when I reread it last year, or maybe earlier this year, I can't remember exactly when it was. I guess at the beginning of this year. You know, having sat down to really just read it in one shot, I was actually very happy with how it hangs together. I liked the final volumes a lot more than I enjoyed them the first time through, where I was kind of like, this, you know, this got kind of... I don't want to say navel-gazy, but definitely a lot heavier.
Yeah.
But now, going back now, I see, like, that's actually very appropriate, and there needed to be a lot of, you know, soul-searching for this character, because he kind of sucked. And it was, you know, like, especially comparing the books to the movie, like, Scott actually does stop and realize, wow, I've done a lot of really crappy things, and... You know, he actually takes the time to make amends and tries to be a better person. It's not like everything is all of a sudden better, but at least, you know, there's the hope that at the end of the story, he has learned things, and the carnage he has inflicted on other people's lives, he's kind of accepted his accountability there and apologized and tried to make amends and can go on being friends with people like Knives and Kim, who he basically trashed in, you know, in the past, just kind of blundering through their lives. So, yeah, you don't really get that in the film, but in the book you do. And I think it really makes a difference in how well those respective works hold up and hang together. Like, I find the movie tough to go back and watch now, but because it's very much, you know, that was very much 2009, 2010 was kind of the peak of Breaking Bad, Mad Men, and other shows like that, where it's like, hey, here's a white guy who just, like, screws over everyone else and has no remorse about what he does. And if he does have remorse, he's able to choke it down, and it's okay because we love him because he's so cool. Well, here's Scott Pilgrim, who everyone seems to think is really cool, but the book is actually pretty good about making it, you realize, like, well, that's actually more his self-image than how he actually is. Like, there are lots of comments about, are you actually evil? just kind of in the background to make you wonder. And, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Michael Cera, but I do think that casting him in the film was a good idea, because I don't think anyone looks at Michael Cera and says, hey, that guy's cool. So, you know, he's kind of like definitely putting on a front that he is awesome. He's like Scott Pilgrim, the strongest fighter in all of Toronto. But at the same time, you're like, well, you know, it's Michael Cera.
You're still this twiggy little 20-year-old.
Right.
But yeah.
I feel like with the movie specifically, there is stuff that they translate across directly from the books that they probably shouldn't have. And there are lines that work in print because you can kind of, I guess, interpret the tone yourself. But when you see it in the film, it's either kind of cringy or kind of gross. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The whole dating a high schooler thing is flagged up in the books how it really ought to be, which is this is not okay.
Everyone yeah, is I mean, like, dude, you're so skeevy.
The first 20 pages of the book are like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And, you know, like, you do over the course of the story, you know, once you meet Envy Adams, you realize like that was just him being cowardly, basically, and trying to find a safe kind of emotional space after being very, very heartbroken. But yeah, it's not really interrogated that way in the film. And in fact, the original idea for the film, the writers, you know, the guys who interpreted the screenplay, which were Edgar Wright and I think Michael Bacall, their original intention for the ending was for Scott and Knives to get back together. And Brian Lee O'Malley was like, whoa, yeah, no, you can't do that.
I don't get how they could read it. Although it wasn't done, was it? It wasn't finished, the comic, when they were making that.
Right. It was being written. The book was being written in tandem with Volume 6, so there was a lot of collaboration and a lot of cross back and forth. Like, you know, the general outline of the book was shared, and, you know, specific plot beats were shared. And then, you know, some of the dialogue from the film made it into the books, actually. Brian Lee O'Malley has said, like, oh, yeah, I thought it was just fair for me to take some of their jokes.
Yeah, I think the book does a pretty good job about explaining, if not overtly, then at least in how it works out, why the sorts of relationships between someone like Scott and Knives is a really bad idea, because sure, Scott is seeing it as this completely innocent, hi, I need essentially a therapist for a girlfriend kind of thing. And he completely makes Knives obsessed because she's not an adult and she doesn't understand the sorts of things Scott is doing to her.
Right.
I think it's really good in those books that Knives comes out on top, like, and recognizes what she wants, and she's much more emotionally mature at the end of those books than I think even Scott is.
Mm-hmm. I would say she has the best character arc in the books. Like, she goes from being someone who is sort of unwittingly pulled into something that is she's just not ready for emotionally, to understanding, you know, the heartbreak that she goes through and realizing, you know, it's fine. Like, we're kids and we make mistakes, and I've moved on. I'm ready to, you know, go to college, live my life. You know, we can still be friends, but that's it. And that's all it's going to be.
I love how imperfect it is, though, despite that, with that scene in Volume 6 where Scott and her make out, and it's horrible for both of them. Yeah. That's so, so shady before that. On my last reread, I mean, when I read it when it was coming out, I knew it was kind of seedy, but I didn't quite know how seedy it was. And then reading it back, it's just kind of like, in 2021, it's just like, I'm like, oh boy, this guy sucks. Like, this is really bad. He's behaving very poorly indeed.
Then he immediately goes and tries to do the same thing with Kim, whose heart he broke a long ass time ago. Yeah. So he basically hits moral rock bottom before he comes out the other side.
This is something I only noticed recently. I know we haven't really got into the plot of Scott Pilgrim. We've sort of been talking the meta of it. But
that's usually what happens on the show. We forget to explain what we're talking about and are just like, let's go deep.
Yeah. People are going to think we're nerds, Jeremy. They're going to think we're a bunch of nerds.
Not that.
But the last time, something I certainly didn't pick up on the first reading, of course, Scott is trying to defeat Ramona's evil exes. And it's not really telegraphed, and I don't, maybe I'm making this up, but is Nega Scott meant to be Ramona's sort of last evil ex?
I thought it was just Scott's, like, self-loathing coming to confront him.
I think that was my initial reading of it as well, but as he's beat, and I'm certainly not, he's not part of the League of Evil Exes or whatever.
I see, it's like his potential, it's like this potential him, basically. Right. That's how I sort of read it, but... The movie made a fine job of making a hash of that, but sorry, go on.
I do take it to be like, oh, Scott is one of the evil exes now, and he has to he has to grapple with that fact.
Yeah, that the at least his the old version of himself. He's trying to, I mean, he's moving on, but I think it also fits in with the evil ex storyline in a way that I weirdly got that from the video game, not like any of the movies or books, which I think probably touches on that. Any part of the story, least of all of the versions of Scott Pilgrim. But I thought that was interesting. I'd love to know if O'Malley sort of meant that, or if it just was a happy coincidence. I bet he meant it. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt.
it is addressed directly that he's, because he's asked to join the league, isn't he? In the League of Evil.
Oh yeah, yeah. Gideon does invite him to join the league at the end. Right, so would someone like to summarize this story?
Scott Pilgrim beats up a bunch of guys so he can date Ramona Flowers. That's it.
That's all there is to it. Wow, that's...
That is pretty much it,
That's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Why are we talking about this?
Why did it take six volumes? Like,
right? Yeah.
Excuse me, sorry, I apologize. A bunch of guys and a girl.
True.
Yes.
Mm. Though he doesn't really beat her up, as I recall.
That's correct.
Thankfully, because that would be troubling.
So, would someone like to get a little more into detail about the story?
Would someone like to summarize it well?
Yeah, I'll go ahead if no one else wants to.
Go for it.
So, Scott is this basically a college-age loser. He lives in Toronto with his roommate, Wallace Wells, and he's in a band with Stephen Sill.
Okay, so it's important to say he's not so much living with Wallace or with Steven so much as he's just like totally freeloading.
Yes.
That's a good distinction to make to kind of describe what Scott is.
Yeah. He doesn't even have his own bed, but he's living with Wallace. He's in a band that, is not the best, but, they have fun. Steven is definitely the one that takes it the most seriously. And it's just generally about his adventures. He runs into this girl at a party, Ramona Flowers, and immediately falls in love with her. And she turns out to be a delivery girl, delivers a package to, I don't remember how he sees that she's a delivery girl.
He has a dream because she does.
That's right. Yeah. She uses subspace, you know, warp zones to make her deliveries. But anyway, he meets her at the party and is obsessed with her. And he's dating Knives Chow, who, as we have already discussed, is a high school girl. And at least the way it's framed in the movie and in the books, you know, nothing really has happened. Like, they haven't even, I don't even think for a long time that they even kiss. Like, they just really just hang out. But she thinks he's cool. And anyway, so he meets Ramona and he orders a package so that she has to deliver him something. And he's like, hey, we should hang out. And they end up hitting it off. He's still dating Knives, but he's talking to Ramona, and he ends up kind of like two-timing them.
Kind of. I mean, like, he sleeps with Ramona, so.
Yeah.
He just sleeps with her, though. That's all. They go to sleep next to each other.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
I think it still counts, but I have to make that distinction.
It's emotional infidelity.
It's on the skeevy scale, at the very least.
It's on the, it's on one of the rungs.
It's a good example of how little Scott thinks about his relationship with Knives versus how much she thinks about it.
Yeah, exactly. Because she becomes obsessed with him and ends up stalking him and using her ninja abilities to do so. But anyway, so Ramona is like, hey, if we're going to do this thing, you have to know that you have to defeat my evil exes. And he's like, well, what do you mean? And she's like, well, you got to beat my evil exes. And he's like, oh, okay. And he just ends up running into them throughout the course of the series. And, you know, in true video game fashion, whenever he beats them, they explode into money and experience.
And even a one-up.
And even a one-up at one point, which is a major plot point. But it's Scott Pilgrim, it does a really good job of mixing the mundane with the fantastic. Like, I think at one point, Knives' dad challenges him to a duel, and he's like a samurai?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's, yeah. Anyway, so I am falling off of the rails here. It's been a while since I've read these.
So basically, kind of on the broader scope of things, Scott just, you know, kind of glides through these encounters with Ramona's evil exes. And, you know, there is the question of, like, why do I have to fight these people? Ramona, are you still in love with your last boyfriend? Because you always mention him. Coming to terms with the fact that Knives is like super obsessed with him because she, you know, was clearly very impressed because he's this older guy. He plays music in a band. She was just, you know, kind of smitten. And, as things go forward, you, discover that Scott has his own, rough relationship in the past. Like basically his ex-girlfriend, Natalie, I believe. Envy.
Natalie Adams.
Yes, Adams. Natalie Adams. She basically became like, what if Scott Pilgrim were successful? Like, she left Toronto, went to New York, and became the singer in a very popular up-and-coming band called The Clash at Demon Head. And, you know, they're kind of like this big thing. And she is like basically what he wanted to be, but, you know, there's this sense that she left him and he just wasn't good enough and kind of lapsed into depression. And that's why he was like, well, I'm just going to hang out with a high school girl because she's going to think I'm cool for who I am, because she doesn't have enough perspective to see that maybe I'm actually kind of a loser. And, yeah, eventually Scott works his way through the evil exes, but Ramona finds out that he two-timed her with Knives, and that their relationship starts to fall apart, and she goes away. She's like, yeah, you know what? You're just as bad as everyone else. So that, you know, starts basically two volumes of Scott soul searching and realizing, wow, like everything sucks and I'm very sad. And eventually coming to terms with the fact that he can't just lay in bed all day and feel sad for himself and has to go out and, you know, get it together. There's a volume called Scott Pilgrim Gets It Together. And that's literally what it is. So eventually, you know, he goes through kind of the low point of his personal journey where he's like, oh, maybe Knives, we can make it work. And they kiss and it's terrible. And he's like, oh, Kim, it's been hinted in the past throughout these books that I broke your heart a long time ago and you kind of resent me, even though we still hang out. Maybe we can make it work. And both of them are like, no, you should be with Ramona because you're both actually a lot alike. So, eventually he, you know, makes it work. He beats the last evil ex and, dies in the process, but he had a one up, so it's okay. He comes back to life. And, there's a very important distinction in the kind of revelatory moment in, or, you know, kind of the climactic moment of the, well, there's a few distinctions in the books and the movie. In the books, he kind of has these symbolic video game moments where he acquires like the Sword of Love or whatever. In the books, he acquires, I believe, the Sword of Understanding as his kind of final, you know, journey, step into his self-growth, like the realization, you know, self-realization of what he is. In the movie, it's self-respect, which is not really the same thing. It's basically saying like, Instead of realizing that I've been terrible and, you know, getting perspective on myself, it's just like, hey, I'm pretty awesome.
Yeah, I shouldn't feel bad.
Yeah, it's basically like, yeah, no, it's like, no, this is what got you into this whole thing. The idea that you're awesome regardless of all your flaws.
Right. So kind of a different message there, which is why I think the film does not work that well.
Yeah, that whole the whole arc of Scott sort of getting it together and getting better and defeating Nega Scott is really brushed over, and I'm sure that's probably the reason that wording was changed.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say I don't think people want to hear me complain about the movie anymore, but the way they do handle Nega Scott in the movie drives me absolutely crazy. Because they treat it as a tossed aside joke. And it's actually quite a funny joke when they're going to confront each other and then they're just walking out chatting. You're like, oh, yeah, he's kind of cool. We've got a lot in common. And I'm just kind of like, what was the point of any of that? That joke's not even funny unless you've already read the comic. Yeah. I don't get that decision at all.
As a meta joke, it works, but like it kind of reinforces, yeah, Scott, no, you haven't gotten rid of your negative traits enough, you know? He's like, oh yeah, no, we're pretty similar actually. And it's like, no, you're not supposed to be.
Yeah.
Am I wrong in thinking that Scott fought Nega Scott immediately before Gideon in the books, and that order is reversed in the movie?
It wasn't immediately before Gideon. It was actually quite a while. It was like toward the beginning of his journey of self-discovery and depression, like right around the time Ramona leaves him, I think.
Doesn't he fight the Nega Scott when he's with Kim and she's like there? She's in a cage or something. Am I imagining that? No, that's earlier.
No, that's the Katayanagi twins.
That's the Katayanagi twins. But I thought Kim was there when Nega Scott was. God, it's been a while since I read the end.
To me, it seems like a sort of logical order of progression for Scott to have defeated Nega Scott, which allows him to gain that understanding, these correct negative traits he'd like to get rid of, and then beat Gideon. But it's sort of thrown in after the Gideon fight in the movie, and that may be the way it is in the comics as well. I mean, they're 12 feet from me, but I'm not going to go get it.
In the comics, they do fight, but then in the end, he just kind of accepts him like as part of himself.
The kind of the climax of the story in the books is that Scott realizes, like, the shitty parts of himself are still part of himself, and he can't just like live in denial of those. He can't defeat them. He has to, you know, take responsibility basically. And so the two merge, and then he teams up with Ramona and they both defeat Gideon together. So like there's a very, very different message there. It's, you know, kind of, you know, I kind of see what they were going for with the film, but like saying, oh, that guy's cool is different than saying that guy's not cool, but he is a part of me and I have to accept the fact that part of me is bad.
I feel like the movie did the sort of dynamic stuff really well. Everything else for me kind of falls apart compared to the books, but compacting six books into one movie was going to be a bit of a tall order.
And I think Edgar Wright is more interested in like funny than necessarily making movies that have a lot of emotional depth and resonance, and that's more his thing, and he's very good at that. But in this case, I think you needed a mix, a balance of both. So yeah, the film doesn't quite work. Like I enjoyed it when it first came out, but in hindsight, it's I tried watching it again a few years later and was like, boy, I don't know.
I do like the opening when they're playing that Beck song. I gotta praise that. That's great. And all the titles are scratched onto what looks like they're scratched onto the celluloid. I love that so much.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah, I think with my revisit recently of the comics, I also watched the movie, and I came away with the same thing, which is I like the first part of that movie much better than I like the ending, because it gets pretty messy.
Yeah, I'd say I have a similar take. It's still really, I don't know, I remember it fondly, but then whenever I watch it, I'm like, this isn't as good as I remember it. It's one of those I'm probably remembering parts from the book.
It has a lot of great set pieces. There's lots of great visuals. There's fun stuff that happens in 5 to 10 minute blocks that are sort of loosely connected. But when it comes to the end to try and make some kind of a story or some kind of conclusion, that's also its great weakness, is that it does not have a story that it set up strongly enough, I think, during the first 70 to 80% of the film.
I think the limited sort of problematic elements of the comics are a lot more glaring in the movie as well, because of the fact that so much of the characters kind of get shortchanged. Not that I'm the expert on this subject, for obviously, but I mean, there are some kind of issues you can raise about stuff like the sort of the way the female characters are treated and like the way that race is treated in the comics to some extent. And then in the movie, because they're boiling everything down to its bare essentials, that stuff just really, it's glaring to me. It's like a klaxon going off. Like, I don't know. But I don't think it's, I mean, I think it could be a lot worse than it is. But in that respect, it doesn't really work for me that well. I think characters like Matthew Patel becoming this kind of Bollywood sort of joke character in the movie is a bit kind of like, I don't know. Although,
yeah,
I don't know if I'm being, if that's over the top or what, but it just kind of makes me a bit, yeah.
No, I get that, because it's kind of the same thing, like, and I realize that, you know, Brian is Asian himself, but, like, nearly every Asian character in the movie is a ninja or a samurai of some sort.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, at least in the comics, you get the impression that his parents, like, one of his parents is Asian, so... You know, it suggests that Scott himself in the comics is meant to be, you know, mixed race also, but that clearly not the case with Michael Cera. he might actually be whiter than me, and that's really saying something.
He's whiter than skim milk. I don't know what you're talking about.
Is that what they're calling me now?
Hey, Jeremy, you're at least 2%.
Yeah.
So you're saying I'm a little fat. Okay, I got it.
Whoa. No, just the quality. The quality. Actually, I'll log off of this call.
That makes, I guess that makes me just ice cream. Jesus.
Oh. Okay. Enough talk about bodies and people and humans. Yeah, no, I agree. There is the fact that, like, yeah, race is not handled that great. And O'Malley has said, like, he regrets having written the characters the way he did because it meant there wasn't a lot of room for diversity in the casting in the film, which, yeah, you know, very unfortunate. I will say that the cast is great.
Yeah.
It's it's a kind of an amazing, like, before they were famous lineup. You've got all kinds of people, like Chris Evans right before Captain America came out. You've got Brie Larson before she became big. Mary, who else? Let's see. Allison Pill is much bigger now.
Was Jason Schwartzman, was he in that? Was he big?
Yeah, he was. He was in. Crap. The
Wes Anderson movie.
Yes, Wes Anderson. Yes, he's a Wes Anderson favorite.
Yeah, he had an HBO show right before Scott Pilgrim, I think, or at least fairly concurrent with it. That was called Bored to Death. It was amazing.
I always get him mixed up with Ben Schwartz, the voice of Sonic the Hedgehog. They're not the same.
They're really not. Also, Aubrey Plaza was in there.
Yes.
And then Scott's sister was played by Anna Kendrick, who was a nobody at the time, but now she's, you know, in a lot of movies. So, yeah, like, really great casting, very kind of an up-and-coming, like, who are these people now? Oh, that's who they are. Good job to the casting department.
I was always deeply disappointed that Simon Pegg and Nick Frost were not the vegan police as, like, this little jokey cameo. I was so ready for that. And then when they weren't, it was such a disappointment because they were basically in every Edgar Wright film.
While I've been critical of the movie, I think that they nailed the whole Todd Ingram arc perfectly. That whole story, I think, is done so well. The scene where he first uses the vegan powers and it all goes to kind of black and white, sort of almost real kind of manga looking. I think that's really impressive. I mean, that's my favorite. Volume 3 is my favorite volume of the comics. I think it's great. And the movie, I thought, did a really good job of it.
I just realized this has Captain America and Superman in it, doesn't it?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I forgot Brandon Routh.
And Lucas Lee is hilarious in it as well.
Yeah. He was one of the highlights of the movie for me. I loved. He was very quotable.
Yeah. Was that Chris Evans? Is he Chris Evans?
Yeah.
Todd Ingram.
Todd Ingram.
Oh, okay. The guy we just
like he
about.
Was the you know the guy who's basically a wall of muscle slab. I mean, Chris Evans was pretty well toned in the movie, but you know, Brandon Routh is like on a different level. Although, the thing that surprised me is when I did the press junket for this movie and interviewed roundtable of cast members, Brandon Routh, even though he's like this massive physical presence. When he got to the game journalist section, he was like, yes, I could talk about Dota. He was like, so ready to talk about video games. That was not what I expected.
Dota. And you're like, all right, now I get to bully you.
Hey, I do want to say they put together a kicking soundtrack for
absolutely.
I mean, given the importance of rock music and indie rock, named indie rock to the original story, they couldn't not. Like, it would have been. Can you imagine if they had just done some Milktoast, Milksop soundtrack for this? It would have been terrible. But they really had to step it up.
That was Beck, wasn't it? Beck did the Sex Bob-omb tracks, like Threshold and Garbage Truck. And I think that was Beck who did those. And I really liked them.
Yeah, no, those are some great original songs.
Yeah, those are really good.
And all the other choices, I mean, what the kids would call it, it slaps. That album slaps.
Yeah, it slaps.
Yeah, in terms of audio visual, like just the vibe and ambiance of the film, like it's perfect. It just needed some more work with the script, I think. A little more time to bake. Anyway, as we wrap up talking about the source material, the comic book, and the film, before talking about the video games, we should talk about the role that video games play in the original story, especially the comic, because there is more to it than just like, haha, I name referenced, Final Fantasy II or whatever.
Yeah.
There's much deeper connections and hooks to the idea of video gaming throughout this, and that's what makes it so interesting. So if you look at the notes, I've kind of put down what I see as like the five ways in which video gaming is woven into Scott Pilgrim. Maybe this is thinking too hard about it, but I think it does speak to, you know, O'Malley's influences, and also it really serves to supplement the story, to enhance the story and drive some of the points across, the themes. I mean, at the most obvious level, you have the textural element of the story, the video games being just a part of everyone's lives, like, you know, the music and comics they talk about. You know, Scott talks about loving X-Men comics, too. So it's not like it's only obsessed with video games. It's just that's a thing that he soaks a lot of energy and, you know, pours a lot of energy into and absorbs himself in. And he's not the only one, but he's definitely the one who is most into the video games. And then, you know, you have the structural element of the story, where the entire thing is kind of set up like a tournament, like a fighting game almost, where Scott has to face off against each of the evil exes, basically one per volume, and they're the boss fight of each volume. And then before
the boss, you got a mirror match.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, you know, there is that structural element to the way the story is told. It also reflects very much kind of a shonen manga style, where you have tournaments in things like Dragon Ball, but also in like sports manga, you know, Prince of Tennis or something, Legend of Tomorrow Joe, or whatever it's called, Hajime no Ippo. It's just like a tradition, you know, a style of manga and anime where it's about a character facing off against more difficult opponents and kind of learning to push his own limits to excel. And, you know, often those characters, especially in shonen manga, are kind of dumb, seemingly sort of worthless compared to the other characters, but they're the protagonist because they're the ones who can push themselves. They're the ones who can, you know, learn to excel at the one thing that they do well, whether it's cooking or boxing or playing tennis or basketball, whatever. In this case, it's, you know, fighting dudes.
I think that structure also makes whether it was intended or not, a great elevator pitch for the series as a whole.
Yeah.
I think we all were talking about maybe not Stuart because he's so cool, he found it himself. But the rest of us were sort of told by friends about this comic and or people we were reading on the internet. And that is like it captures the imagination right away. You can say, hey, this guy has to defeat his girlfriend's evil exes. And it's great. You're done. You're telling them about it in 5 seconds. It sticks mm-hmm. with you. It makes an impression. And clearly, I think it worked to spread that word around certain circles. My guess is that if we traced this back enough, like, it would not take very many generations to get back to Brian Lee O'Malley or someone that knows him personally, the way that these things spread, because it seemed to spread almost entirely by word of mouth, at least early on.
Yeah, no doubt. We're up to three now. The third element is the visual element, where you have a lot of page layouts and just, you know, visual kind of jokes or references to video games, such as when Mr. Chow faces off against Scott. Like, that's a very blatant Ninja Gaiden introductory homage, which in turn itself is, you know, like an homage to Chambara samurai films and things like that. Yeah. But also in the comics, when Scott faces off against Matthew Patel, it's not a Bollywood thing. It's more like it's almost like a Space Channel 5 kind of thing, where it's, you know, he and his team, his friends are all like facing off in, you know, kind of rhythm and unison against Matthew and his demon hipster chicks. And there's no reason, like there's no logical reason for these characters to stand behind Scott. It's like Kim and Ramona and Knives and Wallace and Steven all like together, like doing dance moves with Scott as he's fighting, which, you know, like from a narrative standpoint, doesn't make any sense. But it was really just when he started writing this book, O'Malley really wanted to include a scene like this that was kind of like fighting game slash music game, rhythm game. And so that's what you get, where, you know, you have like the dynamic kind of Street Fighter style punches and KO meters and things like that. It's just, you know, the visuals are heavily informed by video games and that kind of media. There's also the element that I'm referring to as just a goof, where Scott beats up a guy and gets money or a one up or whatever after beating bosses, or he drinks like a, you know, anything except a grape soda and gets stat boosts.
When he beats Lucas Lee and gets the mithril skateboard that he can't use because he's the wrong class right. or something, that's
he
so did, good.
He didn't choose the specialization.
I love that so much.
That was really good.
I also love when he first gets the coin, when he gets the coins from Matthew Patel, and it's not even enough for the bus.
Yeah,
and Ramona's like, "Oh, cool, lend coins. You, I'll lend you like the $2 or whatever." It's just so beautifully done, because it's not like, as I mentioned earlier, it's not like rubbing your face in it. It's not kind of going like, "See, video games, you like that."
Yeah, they don't. They don't address it.
Yeah,
they don't address it. It's just like, this is how the world works.
Yeah, it's just kind of taken for granted that when you beat a guy, they explode into money, and there's never a sense of like, wow, did I kill them? Do they still exist? Like, what happened
yeah, what
to those
happened
people?
To this guy?
I mean, I think the one time that you do kind of see that addressed is when Scott beats Todd, and Envy's like, you just blew up my boyfriend. Of course I'm upset.
Yeah. It's okay. Just walk out of the room and walk back in. He'll respawn. It'll be fine.
I think O'Malley does just such a good job of setting you up for that, because when I picked this up, I think probably one of the reasons I bought it is I probably flipped to the back and saw that fight and was like, oh yeah, I'm buying this. But the way it's set up with Scott casually, like all of the references to say, Sex Bob-omb right at the beginning, obviously, is Mario. When Scott mentions to Ramona about, when she tells him about Sudspace, and he says, is it like in Super Mario Brothers 2? And she's like, no, it's not like that at all. And then at the end, of course, once they're doing this kind of aerial rave combo in midair, and his friends are treating it like, oh, this happens all the time, it's not even a big deal, that's like his new highest number of aerial hits. It's just beautiful. It brings you right into it. It's I think it's really cleverly done, the way it gets you on board. It's not jarring, you know. Yeah. It just works. It fits the world, which up to that point has been relatively grounded until Matthew Patel bursts through the ceiling. It's a great moment, I think.
Yeah, it's done so matter-of-factly. At no point does the book or any of its characters stop and look at the reader and wink and say, video games, eh? It doesn't
video
do that.
Video games, am I right?
Yeah, that's right? My one note. They should have done that in one of the volumes, I reckon.
They should have done it in every volume.
Every page of every volume, every panel.
In the little corner, a little Scott. It looks like a flip book.
I like when characters break the fourth wall to explain jokes to me because I'm too stupid to understand them on my own.
I prefer that too.
See, listeners, Jeremy is actually not too stupid to recognize those jokes on his own. He's being facetious.
All right. Okay. Oh, we do have fun.
Go over that one more time. Sorry.
So finally, the last video game element here, integration, I want to say, is thematic. Namely, what does this whole video game thing say about the characters? Because there are a lot of parallels, and the video game elements do play a meaningful role in the story beyond just like, hey, they're having a fighting tournament against ex-boyfriends and girlfriend. Mm-hmm. I would say on a certain level, the obsession Scott has with video games just kind of speaks to where he is in life right now. He's basically using them as escapism. And the more he kind of gets things together and, you know, finds direction in his life, the less he seems to be fascinated with video games and the less he talks about them, which I don't think is necessarily saying like, hey, if you like video games, you're a loser. It's just more like, you know, he had an unhealthy relationship with them. He was way too into them and not getting on with his life, not being an adult and realizing there has to be a balance in life.
The sequence in volume, I want to say 5, when Ramona has left and the cat has run off and he's depressed as hell, you know he's at rock bottom through this piece of brilliant visual communication, which is that he's playing on a PSP Go, and there is no reason anyone would ever play one of those unless they were at the worst. Like, you just know it's gone bad for him. It's a bit of satire there. Oh, you enjoy that?
That's very good.
But
also at the same time, the fantastical video game elements, you know, they are woven throughout the story and they're taken kind of at face value, but they also serve to underpin the unreliable narrator element of Scott Pilgrim, mm-hmm. which is that Scott, you know, you kind of see this through his perspective. And he sees himself as very cool. Everyone, you know, the girls want to be with him, the men want to be him, et cetera, et cetera. But you also, you know, you see enough of like barbed comments by his friends to realize that's not really the case. He's not as awesome as he thinks he is. And, you know, he has a very skewed self-perception. And the video games elements do tie into that because he, you know, you see flashbacks of his life, and he's like trying to save Kim Pine back when they were dating in junior high from, you know, this ruffian, and, you know, he's all heroic and cool and beats him up to save her, and, you know, everything's awesome and it's just like River City Ransom. But then, you know, like 5 volumes later, that gets Rashomon'd, and you see Kim's actual perspective where she's like, that's not really how it was, Scott. Like, the guy you beat up, Simon, he was just this kind of puny nerd. Like, you were being kind of a bully and you really overreacted and you didn't need to do that. Like, you were way out of line. And mm-hmm. so, yeah. You know, the all the video game visuals and over the top hyperbole, like, you get the impression that really does happen in this world, but at the same time, it also serves to create ambiguity for a lot of the storytelling, where there's, I think, room for certain things to be kind of walked back without it being inconsistent. It's like, well, you know, Scott sees everything kind of in these, yeah. these over the top terms, but that's not really how things work.
The story kind of clues you into that when you see Scott in subspace, because subspace is a exists, at least a certain part of subspace exists inside of Scott's head. So Ramona will occasionally interact with Scott in this like completely dream state of his, because she can travel through subspace as herself. And so Scott will see himself sometimes. I think there's a point where he looks a lot like Link and he's got a little fairy following him around and he's in sort of this, I think he's just kind of playing around and having a great time when everyone else is sort of being serious about things. And at other points he's in subspace when at his lowest, and he is just, he's like almost corpse like in the way he's laying in the middle of this desert, because he's very upset about something. So you can, subspace is almost the only place you can almost feel truthful about, in trying to use that to tease out what is actually happening in real world and what is in Scott's head.
Mm-hmm. I think another aspect of that is where, like, because Scott is literally the protagonist of, you know, the media franchise, but, like, he sees himself as, like, the protagonist of not only his life, but his friends' lives. Like, he doesn't think about his friends as outside of his perception of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that kind of, like, I don't know. I feel like I had a point with this, but I feel like that just kind of helps to color the world in the way that he sees things.
Yeah, I mean,
and that's another thing that makes him unreliable.
In a video game, you're always like the hero of everything. Look at, you know, Mass Effect just was reissued, and that series is really, really bad about that, where basically Commander Shepard does everything in the galaxy. Like, mm-hmm. he or she is single-handedly responsible for basically doing everything, making all the decisions, you know, winning all the battles, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that works in a video game, but it's very rare that you see a video game where it's like, well, you're, you know, part of a larger group. You're, you know, not the only one out there saving the world. I like the Skies of Arcadia did that, where, you know, you could travel around the world and find discoveries and be the first to register those discoveries. But if you dawdled too long, there were other explorers out there who would find things. And I'm sure there are people who are like, I can't get my 100% file now because they came up with this terrible idea. But I think it's really cool. Like, it's not an
a
big
world
empty
exists
world
outside of you.
Yeah, there's things happening, and you know, it's not going to just pause for you. I mean, obviously, like, saving the world, that's going to pause, but there's other stuff happening, and it's not just you out there.
Yeah, I love when games do that.
I don't. I want to be the best, so.
So that, I think, is a pretty extensive discussion of Scott Pilgrim, the book and the film, the books and the film, and just the important role that video game concepts and, you know, history tie into the story and its shape. But of course, naturally, that would feed back into a video game adaptation of Scott Pilgrim. There have been a couple. One of them was mobile, but the one we're really concerned with is Scott Pilgrim versus the World for Xbox 360 and PS3, now reissued on PC, Switch, PS4, Xbox One, all those current, or I guess now semi-last gen systems.
Yeah.
This was a game released in 2010, just around the same time as the film, delisted very shortly after, a couple of years after. And reissued again recently, very early this year, for current-gen consoles after a long time being in absence. And again, I was somewhat involved in the reissue of the game, not the planning or anything, just like producing some content for it. But, you know, if you feel like I can't discuss this objectively, you, sir or madam, are welcome to turn off this podcast and write a nasty review on iTunes. Anyway, what are your thoughts on this game, gentlemen?
It's good.
Well,
all right.
Thanks for listening. That's another episode in the bag.
this is one of my favorite games from that generation. Me and my friends played hours and hours of it. It has a lot in common with Castle Crashers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my same group of friends played through this and Castle Crashers. And both of those, you know, obviously are pretty heavy riffs on River City Ransom, Streets of Rage, Double Dragon, etc. And honestly, it's one of my favorite multiplayer games, and I was ecstatic whenever I heard that they were going to re-release it. Because, like, I still have it on my Xbox 360, but it's my Xbox 360. I don't have it hooked up.
I think I'm probably less enthusiastic about it. I do like it a lot. I think that it's more than the sum of its parts. I think the gameplay, I think the way it's structured kind of incentivizes you to play it in a non-interesting way, which is to grind.
Yeah.
But having said that, I think aesthetically, it totally papers over that. Like, it's so worth playing just to see and hear it, because it's constantly creative, like, visually. The music is fantastic. I want to get this right.
Anna Managuchi, famous as the creators of the world-famous Retronauts intro theme.
I only found that out like 2 days ago. And I was like, I wonder who did the Retronauts. Oh my God.
And that was a Kickstarter stretch goal. So
that's so cool.
Yeah, we were able to give them some money and they gave us some music.
But basically I think it's really good as a product, as a complete thing, and the actual playing of it, sometimes I kind of think like this could have been tailored like maybe a tiny bit better. Like once you know to buy the bionic arm, just makes the whole game easier. Like you don't have to buy it, but then if you don't, you are going to be spending a lot of time beating up quite weak enemies throughout the whole game, and that's fine. You can play it with a friend. You can really just have a blast. You know what? I'm being too fussy. It's really good. I recommend it.
You're not wrong that there is a lot of grinding built into the structure, because it really has this heavy emphasis on the metagame where you play through it and your characters level up and you can gain stat points and make investments and, you know, collect money. And then that carries across to other sessions. So it's like you play until you run out of lives and then, you know, you have to restart that level, but you've got all the stuff that you fell with. And your character is, you know, has got all those buffs. So every time you play, you're stronger, you have more resources, you have, you know, more survivability. I think it's a good balance between the arcade style, get good mentality and just being a total cakewalk. And
I suppose the only issue I have with that is just, there is one way to level up that's so much more efficient than all the others that there's no reason why you wouldn't do it. And that makes it basically totally about your own discipline, which is fine.
But you have to learn. I don't have any discipline. You have to learn what that is first.
That's true. I mean, it doesn't tell you what the items that you pick up actually that you buy do, so, which I don't think it does anyway, which is one of the things I like.
No, it's pretty vague.
Yeah.
It's true.
I'm saying this from a perspective of someone who knows how to do that. It's totally fair enough. Like, if you don't know that, then it's not going to be an issue. But for me, I just know that it's like, this item is the most efficient, cost-efficient way of leveling up. So if I just do level one four times, then I can just have that four times and then everything will be easy, which is really kind of a dumb way to play, really.
it's the value out
of the game in a way.
Like, so you can also play Final Fantasy V where you grind up every single job to max it out as soon as you get that job. But that's not an interesting way to play, in my opinion. Like,
that's
you
true.
Want to, you know, develop those skills as you play along.
I guess it's just because if I don't do that, I find like it takes too long to beat up the early guys. Like, they'll just be on the ground and they'll get up like six or seven times before they're downed, and I just kind of find myself thinking, like, I wish these people would just die.
Fair enough.
Yeah, the game did not stick with me when I first played it. Like, I think it broadly falls under the same criticism I would have with the movie, is that it is a audio and visual treat that has some pretty major flaws that keep it from being a real masterpiece. I mean, as far as the pricing, I mean, if you want to talk about pricing, I think it was $15 at its release. I don't know about the re-release, but I mean, that's a correct price for this game. It's pretty linear. It's cool looking. It's cool to see and play a little bit. But it's not a game that I ultimately had a lot of patience for naturally. Like I sort of, for this episode, you know, I took another look at it, but at the time I fell off pretty quick.
The sprite work with Paul Robertson is just astonishing in places. Like when you fight Todd Ingram and he turns into that kind of Akira vegan, like biomutant sort of thing. I do love that. Would it be churlish or would it be inappropriate to point out that it has that kind of Paul Robertson making the female characters maybe a touch fan servicey and sort of pneumatic in a slightly jarring way?
Incredibly jiggly, and it's very jarring. Yeah,
it is. At the same time, the lead animators were Justin Sear, Jonathan Persona Sama Kim, and Mariel Kinoko Cartwright. So she, like, her art is very much in that style too. I don't know. It's a complicated thing when you're like, oh, I don't like the way these women are depicted when they're being depicted by a woman. I don't know.
Well, it's not that I'm saying that I dislike it. I'm just saying that it's very noticeable to the point where it almost kind of, it takes away from other aspects of the sprite art.
Yeah,
to me
that's
personally.
Fair.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is a lot of talent that was, you know, behind this game. The lead designer was Jonathan Levine, who had previously worked on Ubisoft's T Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles game from 2007. Then went on to found Tribute Games, and he's worked on Mercenary Kings, Ninja Senki DX, and most recently Panzer Paladin.
That's such a good game.
Yeah, it looks like
excellent.
He's got a great CD.
It's on my list. I haven't got to play it yet. Mm.
The art director, as mentioned before, was Paul Robertson, who kind of, at that point, I think, was best known for Baby Pirate Battle Cabana and, you know, had done a lot of work doing stuff for WayForward. But this was a game where he was basically told, like, turn this world into sprites. And he, like, came up with all these character designs. He's largely responsible for throwing in all kinds of fan service details for, you know, people who love the books. I think the game does a great job of bridging the divide between the books and the film, and it falls more on the book side of things.
There's stuff like when you fight, before you fight Matthew Patel, Crash and the boys have just played the last song Kills Audience, mm-hmm. which I don't think that happens in the movie at all. So that's a nice little throw-in reference.
Yeah, everyone's comatose when you go into fight.
Yeah, and they all disappear, like they've been killed. Like, they flash out of existence, like they're enemies. It's great.
Yeah, there were. The game is pretty interesting in that it took some liberties to make some additional backgrounds for some of the action to happen in, so it wasn't just Toronto or Dingy Club in Toronto, which is where a lot of the books takes place. There was a graveyard, which was
hit with zombies as well.
Yeah. And there's a flying Tengu. I think it's like a Japanese restaurant.
Yeah, the flying Tengu.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I don't know what to make of this, but I feel like a lot of the Asian characters in the comics were Chinese. Mm-hmm. But then the game spends a lot of time with Japanese culture instead. And there's like a little bit of confusion there, I think, in the game, because I feel like you see Knives' mom presented with a lot of Japanese characters, and she's Chinese, and I don't know.
She has a little word balloons that pop up, and they're Chinese.
Okay, yeah, I just found it weird that there's such a presence of Chinese culture in the books, and then it's almost completely replaced with Japanese culture in the game.
I mean, in a sense, not that I'm defending that because I'm not the person to do that, but in a sense, it calls to mind what adaptations of Western properties were like to some extent in maybe like the NES era. There's a lot, I can't think of any examples. I know this is a thing, but when you get Japanese developed video games based on Western properties, you did sometimes have things like that kind of crop up. So I wonder if that's consciously making that connection. You know,
like I'm not sure.
Maybe. Probably not, but, you know, just throwing it out there, I suppose.
My assumption is that because a lot of the game, I mean, this game is obviously heavily based on Japanese video games, especially from the 8-bit era, that it's more that connection. That it just seemed, it was sort of noticeable to me when I played it through this time that was kind of a sort of a sleight of hand swap of what Asian culture was presented in the media.
That is, yeah, I mean, that's true. I hadn't really thought about that, but you're right. Although you do fight the Katayanagi twins, who are Japanese, but they're not tied to the restaurant in any way. So
no,
they just have cool robots. Yeah, but the game overall, like, I think it holds together pretty well because it's so satisfying to play. Like the combat mechanics and the way you combo into things, everything just feels good.
There's a lot of scope for skilled play with the ricochets and items and things. Yeah, it's
great. Yeah, I don't mind the grinding quite so much because I feel like every time I'm not just doing the same thing over and over again. There's so many moves and so many different animations. Like, as someone who had to pick through the sprite sheets for that strategy guide book, there are so many sprites and animations. Like, like one playable character has more distinct sprites than you would have found in the entirety of most NES games. It's just ridiculous. And even the enemies have tons and tons of animations and moves. So there's a lot of variety within, you know, the kind of limited sandbox if you are fighting by walking left to right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But yeah, the game looks great. It sounds great. Again, soundtrack by Anna Monoguchi. It has a real River City Ransom style vibe. I would say it's probably the best adaptation of a River City Ransom, the River City Ransom concept that is not actually by Technos or Arc System Works, I guess, at this point.
I'd agree with that.
And it has tons and tons of references to the other games that inspired Scott Pilgrim in the first place. Like, I was astonished when I realized Tom Guycott is a character you fight, like the villain of Clash at Demon Head is he's just a rabble. And then you see you see Billy Bang Blitz in the background of the club at the end. And of course the finale of the whole thing, obviously, like, you're going up the fire escape to fight the Katanayagi twins, and it's basically like a, you know, kind of an auto scroller and very much in the style of a Mega Man X game. But then you get to the club and you fight Gideon and he has multiple forms. And after all of that, there's like this final encounter, and it's absolutely just taken straight from Mega Man 2. Once you beat the Wily Machine and have to go through that cavern full of the dripping puddles of acid and, you know, fight the alien that's actually just a hologram. Like, they just lifted that straight, and it's kind of brazen, but I respect it.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of Gideon's forms has big Kefka from Final Fantasy VI vibes to it. It's this sort of manneristic, like, grotesque pile of flesh of all the previous bosses with him at the top. Don't think he is quite as excited as Kefka is, but otherwise it looks very much like that scene.
Yeah, if you check out some of the character sketches, the development sketches that are on, I think, Jonathan Kim's blog, I think that's where you find it, there were some concepts for Gideon, the final encounter, that were just straight up the Kefka Tower, like, just absolutely that. And there was another one where he's basically Uriel from Street Fighter 4. So they were, you know, heavily leaning on their influences, but, you know, in the context of a different game based on a different property with different play mechanics and style. So it's it feels very true and faithful to the comic, and
it totally makes sense that the video game adaptation is going to really dig deep into video game culture as well and history, given what the comic is like. They have a really good excuse to be doing stuff like this, so it totally works. I think
one of the best jokes in the game is I don't know if it's the beginning or midway through the Todd Ingram fight, where it is it's a bass battle that looks a whole lot like Guitar Hero or Rock Band.
Right.
And Todd has this insane fretboard of just endless notes coming down. And Scott has this one single little green note. And then if you attempt to press it, you just end up punching Todd. So it's not only a reference, but I think it also becomes this in-game joke as well, that, you know, Scott can't really play bass that well, and then he just ends up punching the guy.
I will say one of my absolute favorite things about it is the way that the art style kind of marries Brian Lee O'Malley's artwork with kind of the little short squat River City Ransom looking dudes. I think it's one of those things where it's like, I don't think that Brian was influenced necessarily by the little short squat dudes or anything, but like, he just kind of naturally has that kind of square headed style, like with the stocky limbs and everything. And it just ended up working out beautifully. Mm-hmm.
I feel like we haven't talked about Wallace Wells enough at all. Can I just say, I love him. He's the best.
I was about to say, you mean the best character?
Oh God, yes.
I love that he's unlockable, and his idle animation is just like standing around with a martini.
He's amazing in the books. He's the best character in the film, I think, as well. Kieran Culkin, I think, played him.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I just love Wallace Wells, and I want there to be a sequel series that's just about Wallace Wells doing stuff.
I would pre-order that day one. That would be amazing.
Oh, I should probably mention, did anyone read Seconds, the follow-up to this?
Yes.
I did.
To Scott Pilgrim? Yeah. Okay. That was good, wasn't it?
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
there's a brief Scott and Ramona cameo, I think near the end of Seconds. Is that right?
I believe so, yeah. I think they're in the background of the restaurant or something. I don't, it's been a while, but I remember seeing them.
I think that, I think it seconds is sort of reinforces something I mentioned earlier, where it seems like he Brian Lee O'Malley writes about sort of the previous part of his life. And by the time you get to seconds, he's writing about like late 20-year-olds and the problems they face. Versus like these like early to mid 20s from Scott Pilgrim. And it's a different vibe, and I think his sort of updated artistic style fits it a lot more.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that is Scott Pilgrim versus the world versus the podcast versus everything. He's a very contrarian fellow. Gentlemen, thank you all for your time and your commentary and your expertise. It's been a pleasure having you here. I believe we are done talking about Scott Pilgrim now, but I do think it was a good conversation to have about a work that really kind of broke a lot of ground in saying, hey, video games are valid, and it's okay for you to like video games, although you shouldn't like them so much that you ignore the rest of your life and date high school girls. So yes, thanks for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode, I have phenomenal news for you, because Retronauts is a podcast that comes out on all your favorite podcatchers every Monday. And if you really like it and would like to support it, I have even better news, because you can go to patreon.com/retronauts for $3 a month. You can hear every episode we publish, or every Monday episode we publish, a week early. So that's the Monday before the other Monday, right? And it'll be in a higher bitrate quality with no advertisements or cross promotions. That is our pledge to you. If you subscribe for $5 a month, you get 2 bonus episodes every other Friday. You also get weekly columns and mini podcasts from Diamond Fight. And I believe Discord access to the Retronauts Discord that is opening sometime soon at the time of this recording will probably be open by the time this episode of Retronauts goes up. So that's a thing that we are offering you for your support for this show, because this show is completely community funded. And of course, we are a part of the Greenlit Podcast Network, as are all of these fine folks on the show with me. So let's do the rounds here. Aaron, please tell us where we can find you and listen to your podcasting opinions.
Excellent. You can listen to me on Video Death Loop, which is a podcast you can find basically anywhere where you get your podcast. Especially, you can find it on the Greenlit Podcast Network. It's out every Friday. My friend John and I watch a short video clip on repeat and essentially try and keep ourselves entertained while we go a little bit mad. And also, I would like to point out, if you find yourself in the Knoxville, Tennessee area, my short form improv show has just recently started performing again. If you're here on a Tuesday, swing by, search for Einstein Simplified, and you can come see me in person.
All right. JP.
Yes, you can find me on the Greenlit Podcast Network with the podcast Whatever Nerd, wherein we take a topic each week, and we usually try and have a guest or someone, and we just kind of delve into it and talk about the history of it and talk about our personal experiences with it. The one we have coming up on Tuesday is going to be about wrestling, so if you happen to like that, be sure and check it out. You can find us at whatevernerd.com or any podcatcher, pretty much.
And Stuart.
Hello, I'm Stuart. You can listen to, you can listen to me on Retronauts sometimes. You can find my other podcast, Animani Chat with Luke Fletcher, also on the Greenlit Podcast Network. A pattern has emerged. and what that is about watching the TV show Animaniacs episode by episode. And the secret twist is I hate Animaniacs. I hate it so much. It makes me so mad. But now we have to put ourselves through this for the sake of your entertainment. And I do some other stuff too, so look for me on Twitter at Stupacabra. Try to ignore my terrible tweets, please. Just look for the links, find my stuff.
That's the appeal, the terrible tweets. All right. finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, doing stuff at Limited Run Games, including writing and editing books on Scott Pilgrim. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite, and you can also watch videos where I talk about old video games, older than Scott Pilgrim by far, but possibly influential on Scott Pilgrim. Just on YouTube, look for my name, Jeremy Parrish. There's only one R in Parrish because 2 R's is wrong. Don't trust anyone who does that. Yeah, that's it. So thanks, everyone. And I don't have a punchy outro, so goodbye.